won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. The Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warned, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban vote comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by the members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported, amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
On Saturday, Iran's parliament began its open session differently, hosting some of the ministers-to-be and the president himself to attend the vote of confidence session. The process began after week-long behind-closed-doors deliberations on Raisi's proposed list of ministers. Based on the parliament regulations, the president is given 2.5 hours' time to introduce and defend his nominees before 5 pros and 5 cons from lawmakers speak against or in favor of the list.
The reform program pursued by the administration is the centerpiece of the proposed minister's agenda. The program is based on 5 pivotal points. First, a statement on the second step of the Islamic revolution. Second, improving Islamic and Iranian values. Third, pursuing economic resilience. Fourth, improving the livelihoods of the people, especially low-income families. Fifth, promoting international relations based on national interests.
The process will then involve the introduction of the nominated ministers one by one, and based on the Persian alphabetical order of the ministries. For each minister, two pros and two cons will speak, each for 15 minutes, before the nominees take the podium to defend their qualifications for 30 minutes. Majlis says it will work two shifts every day to wrap up the process swiftly.
Parliament maintains a cooperative stance toward the government. We will work two shifts a day to cover up to five nominees every day. If all goes as planned, we will hold the final session on Tuesday.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 10 days ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then reviewed the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week. The open floor vote of confidence sessions are expected to run until Tuesday, when the final voting will be held for the 19 ministerial picks.
Lawmakers say in their voting, they bear in mind that the proposed lineup is the team that the president wants to work with. And given Raisi's close ties with parliament, it's expected that the majority of the nominees will win the green light to sit on the ministerial chairs. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian President, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the US. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubtless wrong. and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbas.
Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country, with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless acts there in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his whole household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be honest in all our believing, to commit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees have just crossed into Iran, a country they call it a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak crossing point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now, with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protest, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners' relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Herabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice.
It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison insists Australia can reopen once vaccination targets hit, but some state leaders aren't so sure. We're prepared for you an article written by Sarah Martin. Under the heading, Morrison facing state resistance over reopening plan as New South Wales COVID crisis worsens. The article was published by the Australian Associated Press News Agency. States are continuing to push back against the terms of a nationally agreed plan to open up the country once vaccination rates hit 70% and 80%, warning the worsening COVID crisis in New South Wales could yet be a deal-breaker. As a pared-down federal parliament prepares to sit in Canberra amid the Australian Capital Territory's lockdown, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is insisting that growing case numbers are not a reason to abandon the national plan agreed to by all states and territories. Under the four-phase strategy signed off in July and based on modelling from the Doherty Institute, restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of the disease are relaxed once 70% of Australians aged over 16 are vaccinated, with stringent lockdowns unlikely to be required at this stage. Once vaccination coverage reaches 80%, only highly targeted lockdowns would be necessary, and vaccinated Australians would be free to travel interstate. National Cabinet has requested updated advice from the Doherty Institute that takes into account the current caseload, which jumped by 917 on Sunday, 22nd of August. But Prime Minister Scott Morrison insisted that the outcome would remain the same. Morrison told the ABC's Insider program, "The starting point doesn't ultimately change the ultimate conclusion point of where case numbers arrive." Adding, "As we go forward, once you get over 70% and particularly over 80%, lockdowns do more harm than good." Scott Morrison added, "Lockdowns are not a sustainable way to deal with the virus, and that's why we have to get to the 70% and 80% marks so we can start living with the virus." After recent National Cabinet meetings, Scott Morrison warned state and territory leaders not to abandon the commitment made to the Australian people to ease restrictions, while the Treasurer, Jos Frydenberg, has said the Commonwealth won't financially support the states locking down once vaccination targets are reached. However, on Sunday, 22nd of August, the Queensland Deputy Premier, Stephen Miles, said the states had agreed to the national plan before the New South Wales outbreak, and Queensland could still close the border to New South Wales even when vaccination rates reach 80%. Queensland Deputy Premier Stephen Miles said about the potential border closures, he said, "We may, it will depend on the situation here and the situation in New South Wales," adding, "We're signed up and committed to the plan that National Cabinet endorsed, but that was a plan that was endorsed before the New South Wales outbreak." The Premier of Western Australia, Mark McGowan, also cast doubt on whether Western Australia would be prepared to abandon its elimination strategy, saying the state wanted to continue to try to crush and kill the virus. He also said that lockdowns could still be used by states and territories to contain the spread of the virus under the agreement signed off by the states. Western Australia Premier Mark McGowan also said, "I think what's happening in New South Wales is obviously tragic and very difficult for the people there, but there's an Australia outside of New South Wales, and we're all doing our best to keep the virus out, and we're following the national plan." Mark McGowan noted, "Queensland, Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, we're all pretty much now COVID-free. Victoria is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus using measures that have been proven to work." He added, "The Act is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus. New Zealand is doing everything it can to crush and kill the virus. It's only New South Wales that is not. They're letting down the entire country." Mark McGowan added, "It is very, very debilitating for the Federation and for everyone else that's trying to do the right thing." However, the Chief Medical Officer, Professor Paul Kelly, said there was no jurisdiction in the world that had eliminated COVID-19, with the Delta strain now also upending the New Zealand government's success to date with the virus. Professor Paul Kelly added, "Western Australia have done extremely well up to now, mostly relying on the very strong border controls, both external to the rest of the world and to the rest of Australia." Professor Paul Kelly added, "The matters of how Western Australia see themselves working through the pandemic over time is really a matter for them. But I will say that the whole of the National Cabinet, including the West Australian Premier, did sign up to the plan only a couple of weeks ago." The Doherty Institute Director of Epidemiology, Professor Jodie McVernon, also said pursuing a COVID-zero strategy would be difficult with the Delta strain of the virus. Professor McVernon added, "We have seen how contagious this virus is. We have seen how difficult it is to keep it out. And even in jurisdictions that have had highly effective public health responses and contained outbreaks, it has been getting away." The Labour leader, Anthony Albanese, said the Doherty Institute modelling had not advised that the country could reopen once the vaccination target was reached, with hundreds of active cases. He said if the Prime Minister had information that showed rising case numbers need not impact our plan to reopen, then he needs to release that advice. Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese said, "No one wants to be locked down for a day more than necessary." Labour is expected to continue its assault on the government over the vaccine rollout when Parliament sits in the coming days, having said half the country would not be in lockdown if the Morrison government had secured more vaccines earlier. Fewer than 50 MPs are expected to sit in the House of Representatives, and the Senate chamber is expected to be half empty under strict conditions governing the final two sitting weeks of the current session. The merit of Australia's 20-year mission in Afghanistan is expected to be debated in the lower house of the parliament, while the government has prioritised national security laws, disability support reform, and changes to the way elections are run on its legislation program.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Lebanon has been under economic pressure for at least 2 years now, from major currency devaluation to lack of fuel and electricity. The Lebanese people have been targeted. Now, according to the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, it is the United States which is mostly behind the suffering of the Lebanese people. We'll be talking about what is happening in Lebanon and why. I want to start it off by welcoming our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh. Mariam, well, please, fill us in. We heard Sayed Hassan speak tonight. Fill us in on where we are right now in the situation in Lebanon.
Well, it's basically a brief speech today. He was able to highlight the major problem and what the problem is. And although he said that we do have mismanagement, we do have a lot of corruption in the country, however, what we're witnessing right now is a battle. It is a battle being forced upon Lebanon by the U.S., and it is being orchestrated by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. He did specify and stress that the main reason for the lack of provision, the lack of fuel, the fact that the major companies are not distributing fuel, the fact that even that we have monopolizers, even that is being orchestrated by the U.S. And smuggling of fuel out of the country, smuggling of, as he said previously, smuggling of U.S. dollars outside the country was also orchestrated by the U.S. in order to choke the Lebanese people. And what he stressed on today was the fact that this is not only targeting Hezbollah, it is not only targeting the supporters of Hezbollah and the resistance and all those nationalist people and the patriots in the country, it's also targeting everyone, even those that are the allies or the so-called friends of the U.S., and he also called on them to heed this fact that they will not be gaining anything from all of this. He also highlighted the fact that after Hezbollah's, the Secretary General had declared that a shipment from a fuel will be leaving Iran before an Ashura, and today he declared there will be another ship which will be coming into to Lebanon in the coming days. He said that this coincided with promises, which he called empty promises, from the U.S. ambassador here in Beirut, saying that the U.S. will work on negotiating and bringing in funds from the World Bank in order to bring in gas from Egypt through Jordan and Syria. And he said that these are false claims. Why? Because this requires several issues. First of all, it requires that the U.S. Congress itself approve such a movement, because it also requires that the Lebanese government negotiates and holds talks with the Syrian government, which the U.S. Is, of course, prohibiting, in order for the Syrian government to allow that gas to come into Lebanon through its territories. Of course, he spoke about so many issues. There's not enough time to perhaps brief them all, but the major point is that Hezbollah is on their way to bringing in fuel into Lebanon in order to ease the tension, to ease the sanctions. This is something that is perhaps very major and very close to what we saw in the war in the year 2006. That was considered a major confrontation directly between the U.S. That was a war enforced upon Lebanon by the U.S., of course, through its tools, specifically Israel. Now we have another form of a war, which is majorly economic and social, and we see here Hezbollah very clearly confronting, and as the Secretary General said, that they would once again be victorious.
Thank you very much for that update. Out of Beirut, that's Maryam Saleh. I'd like to welcome now my guest, Spotlight, journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair, out of Brussels. And Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammed Marandi, out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off in Tehran. Mohammed, you heard what Maryam was saying, and of course it was a summary of what the Secretary General has said. Why is it that, first of all, if you agree with the analysis, why is it that the United States would want to see the Lebanese people suffer? What do they want to get out of this?
Well, the United States wants Israel to be able to dominate the territories surrounding it. So they would like to see Egypt as a failed state. They would like to see Jordan as a failed state, and both of them are failed states. And they would like to see Syria, which was a strong country, broken to a degree. They've achieved that. The Syrians, of course, have fought back, and they've been able to defeat much of what the Americans and NATO has thrown at them, the dirty war and Al-Qaeda and ISIS to a large degree, but it has still caused enormous suffering, and now the Americans have imposed sanctions on the Syrians that are an attempt to achieve what they couldn't achieve through the dirty war. The same is true with Lebanon. The United States wants to crush Lebanon. It wants to destroy the social fabric in order to bring down the resistance against Israel so that Israel can dominate. It's a tool, the sanctions that the Americans use across the world. They crush nations, they crush people. You don't see it in the news. It's not something that's dramatic. People die quietly, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba or Libya or Yemen, through the barbaric starvation siege that the Americans helped the Saudis impose. And they did it in Iraq. If you remember, during Saddam Hussein, the Saddam Hussein that they created and gave chemical weapons to, later on they sanctioned Iraq because of the Saddam Hussein that they created. And when 500,000 children had died because of the sanctions, the U.S. Secretary of State said, it's worth it. So it's not. This is not new. These tactics, these policies are not new. The Americans know exactly what they're doing. They are brutal. They are barbaric. They're inhumane. But they are the norm. And the very fact that the Western media really doesn't say anything about this shows that Western countries don't have a free media. Okay. They're all controlled by the powers that be.
Okay. Well, Elijah, what do you think? You heard Mohammed said basically the U.S. is implementing policy that it does all over. I want to look at that aspect because it just seems that if that's the case, it's a copy-paste type of scenario, trying to create failed states, as Mohammed said, throughout the region and beyond. It just seems that there would be lessons that people would learn from other states, because we see inside of Lebanon, there are some various groups that either buy into what is being said, or because they perhaps benefit from the suffering itself. What do you make of that side of things and what needs to be done? I mean, Said Hassan Nasrallah talked tonight about basically it's not one group or it's not Hezbollah that's being targeted, but all of the Lebanese people, so they are all in it together.
Absolutely. What the Americans are doing is trying to break the back of the axis of the resistance by economic sanction and pushing the state of Lebanon, Syria, even Iraq and Iran into a failed state. But because they have failed militarily in breaking Hezbollah in 2006, breaking Syria in 2011, and Iraq, in 2014, and they want to divide the country and also imposing the harshest sanction on Iran, so they're changing their style into sanction now to starve the population. But what they are doing is, in some places like in Lebanon, is turning against the Americans, because the Americans have friends in every country where the axis of the resistance is deployed and exists, where there is a society that formed this axis of the resistance. However, the more the Americans are tightening the rope again around the neck of the member of the axis of the resistance, the more this axis of the resistance in finding other ways to come out and take the benefit of these sanctions and these harsh period and turning them into positive opportunity. So we see the solidarity among the axis of the resistance that is very important in this case. And thanks to the Iranian support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran is sending one ship starting a few days ago, and then it's followed by other ships, as Sayyid Nasrallah said. That means the Iran is not leaving its the member of the axis of the resistance that represent part of is national security and part of this one nation that is standing against the U.S. hegemony and is trying to support Lebanon as best as possible. Now, Iran is not going to substitute the country, the government, and is not going to be able to support another state, exactly what Iran did in Syria. It has managed to make sure that the Syrian will not starve, and what it's trying now to do is managing to make sure that the Lebanese are not going to stop, and they're not going to just submit to what the Americans are doing, because the Americans want Hezbollah to deliver its weapon to serve Israel, so Israel can benefit from defeating Hezbollah when they fail to do that militarily. And I don't think this is going to happen, because now Hezbollah is gaining more popularity, because what Sayyid Nasrallah said, that the Iranian oil will be distributed to all hospitals regarding their religion or their belief, to all bakeries, to all the wherever there is an industry of a medical industry, and that will be distributed equally.
Okay.
Now, it's not going to be able to satisfy the population, but it's going to at least come out of this harsh sanction.
What about that, Mohammed? I mean, the leader of Hezbollah said that they talked about the fuel being brought in from Iran, and that it's not just one ship, but it's an opening to a whole new path. And he also talked about people being wrong about these international sanctions on Iran. He says these are unilateral, illegal U.S. sanctions that are illegal, and people have to think beyond that. Your take on this whole act with Iran and sending fuel, tell me about the importance of that and perhaps being able to break this whole hegemonic control that these certain Western states think that they have in this region.
If one reads the Western media or watches Western media outlets, one would think that these are indeed international sanctions. but they're only American sanctions. But I think that is a part of Eurocentricism. That's their racism kicking in. That's their exceptionalism kicking in, where they think that if they, the Europeans, the Americans, the Australians, the New Zealanders, if they impose sanctions, that means the world has imposed sanctions, because they are the international community. That's how they see the world. That's how they view themselves. And that's how they call themselves the civilized world and the rest of us the uncivilized world. They call themselves the free world and the rest of us the unfree world. But the free world is not going to hear anything about the atrocities being committed by their own armies, by their own soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, and the way in which they're crushing the populations of Cuba or Venezuela through sanctions, or Iran for that matter, preventing Iran from importing masks, preventing Iran from importing vaccines and the equipment to produce vaccines. They're not going to hear that because the free world doesn't give that sort of information to their public. So we should expect nothing but this sort of representation, this sort of narrative building in the West, where Western sanctions or American sanctions are universal sanctions. No, these are sanctions imposed by the Godfather, the United States being the global Godfather, and the Iranians are not going to accept that. And the Iranians broke the sanctions imposed by the Godfather against Venezuela. They did it against Syria, now they're going to do it against Lebanon, because this is one of the best ways to defeat American hegemony, to show that these sanctions can be broken and that the Americans cannot do anything about it. That creates, that encourages other powers like China and Russia to do the same on other fronts.
Well, Elijah, as Sid Hassan says, pointed the finger at the American embassy in Lebanon as the main culprit, trying to destabilize Lebanon. Let's talk about the role of what's supposed to be a diplomatic entity, but basically trying to cause chaos. And of course, Sayed Hassan even talked about goal being civil war in Lebanon.
The American is like a country, like the decision maker in the country, to the point that the American ambassador just phoned the president to tell him about a new plan to drag gas from Egypt and Jordan through Syria and to Lebanon, just as a reaction to what Sayed Nasrallah said about the Iranian and diesel oil tankers that are coming to Lebanon. And by communicating that via phone without showing any documents or any plan or any thoughtful ideas, the Americans are, first of all, just dealing extremely rudely with the president of Lebanon. Secondly, just not asking Syria its opinion, notwithstanding the Caesar Act that imposed sanctions on Syria, and how this plan is going to be materialized. Thirdly, this plan, if materialized, needs a year, which means the Lebanese population should wait for the blessing of the American to receive their gasoline, and all that forwarded by the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon. So it's like acting like the decision maker in the country, but reacting really surprisingly lightly as an ambassador. And I think what is really driving the American off the hook is because Sayed Nasrallah and Iran are spoiling the plan of the U.S. to starve the population and to turn their guns against Hezbollah and to blame Hezbollah for the dire situation in the country, when the ally of the U.S., the corrupted ally of the U.S., are the source of the situation and the financial crisis. So, yes, the Americans are behaving like they are the decision maker in the country.
Spoiling the plans of the United States is what Elijah said, Mohammed. I think that's probably the main problem that the United States has with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now if we look at the resistance front, we see that pressure has been increased across the axis. But at the same time, we don't see any part of the resistance acquiescing. I mean, what exactly does that say? What message does that send to the United States and its allies?
The most important thing is that it shows that the members of this alliance or this axis of resistance, they're not proxies. These are people who have a mutual belief, a similar ideological understanding of how things are in the world today. They're anti-imperialist. They're anti-American hegemony. They want the Americans off their backs, whether it's in Yemen or Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or Palestine or Afghanistan or Iraq. The United States has built an empire and has manipulated the people of the region for many decades, and the Europeans before the Americans. So the West as a whole has been a very destructive force in this region, just like everywhere else in the world. And therefore, no matter how much pressure the Americans impose on the populations, even though there are going to be people who side with the Americans, these elites or these business people or these westernized figures in each society will advocate American policy, the bulk of these societies know what the United States stands for. It stands for oppression, it stands for injustice, and it stands for hierarchy.
Okay,
hierarchy.
I'm going to have to just jump in here because I'm going to throw it back at Elijah just for the last minute. Now, Elijah, many would say that the main problem for Washington and its allies is actually that the resistance is stronger than ever, both inside of Lebanon and beyond. And it's in a situation now, they're in a situation that they will do anything possible to stop this wave of the axis of resistance. Your take in 1 minute.
I don't think it's too late for the Americans to do anything to stop the course of the path of the axis of the resistance. I think Americans are on their way out from West Asia. They've left Afghanistan humiliated. They're going to do that in Iraq, and they're going to fail in Lebanon dramatically, as they are failing in Gaza with their Israeli ally. And they're exactly failing again in Syria, even if they're starving the population. I think the determination of the axis of the resistance is much stronger, and the occupier's destiny is only to the dustbin of history.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this spotlight. Elijah McNair, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and right here in Tehran, Professor of International Studies from the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out.